Hey, welcome to Script Lock, a relaxed discussion about narrative and writing in video games. I'm your host, Nick Folkman.
And I'm your other host, Max Folkman. We've written Massive Chalice for Double Fine, and today our guests are Brendan Chung and Bree Code. Bree started as a programmer at Relic, working on Company of Heroes and Warhammer. Then she moved on to Pandemic in Australia, and then Ubisoft Montreal, working on three Assassin's Creeds and Child of Light, where she was lead programmer. Currently, she is in parts unknown, away from Ubisoft. And Brendan started out making mods for Quake 2, Doom 2, Half-Life 2, and established the Citizen Able universe. And then worked at Pandemic Los Angeles on Lord of the Rings Conquest and Full Spectrum Warrior, and also Gravity Bone on his own time. After Pandemic closed, he went full-time into Blendo Games and released Flotilla, Air Forte, and Zombie Smasher, 30 Flights of Loving, and is currently working on Quadrilateral Cowboy. Let me know if I screwed these up.
Perfect. Perfect.
Great. So, Bree.
Yes.
I found a quote on the internet where you said, "Make sure you are one of the least smart and least experienced people on your team. Always work with people that are better than you, and don't be afraid to ask questions. In this way, you'll learn faster than if you were the resident expert." This is what this podcast is. So thank you for being two extremely smart people who are way more well-spoken and intelligent than we are.
Oh, I'm not sure about that, but we'll see. That's advice from my dad.
What's your dad do?
He's a computer programmer also.
And his last name is also Code?
His name is Bill Code.
Whoa.
Wow.
Bill Code. Okay, Bree, on a bunch of your profiles on the internet, you say you are interested in AI and narrative systems.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about what those are and why you like them.
Well, I started writing AI for RTS. That's what I did at Relic. When you play against the computer on Company of Heroes, you're playing against me and another guy. Then, over the course of my career, I got interested in open world games and AI programming in open world games, which is about kind of bringing the characters to life. But I think there's a big gap between where we could be and where we are, because we don't focus as much on the open world as we do on creating this perfect linear story through the open world. And I would like to just like not worry about that at all and create systems that tell stories through the open world, through the characters in the open world, like many, many, many side quests authored by systems.
So Nick and I can picture how complicated that could be on the writing side, but how, I have no idea on your end with your experience how hard that is and what the challenges are. So what are they?
There's sort of two approaches to this problem, I think. One is to create a lot of writing, a lot of branching narrative. Games like Dragon Age have a lot of branching narrative. And then another approach is to forget about written story and have more of a player-driven story through the player's interactions with the game systems, and it's more gameplay and a series of moments. I would like to see something that combines these two philosophies so that, because I really like dialogue and like written narrative as well as what emerges from the gameplay, I don't want to abandon dialogue, but is there a way that you could create little pieces of moments and dialogue and any kind of way to tell a story and modularize these pieces and have some kind of system stringing them together dynamically so that story is happening in a conversation between what moments the player is choosing to participate in and what the writers of the game, the authors of the game, want to say.
Do you think we're moving towards that? For me, it feels like we're moving towards more total player agency and like less of a story altogether, or less of an authored story.
I feel like the industry isn't moving in one direction, but in many directions. Like right now we think of video games as one thing, but eventually maybe there'll be more than one thing. And so, you know, games like the Telltale games will exist and be one thing, and then games that are about interacting with systems will be another, and there'll be other things in between.
Brendan?
Yeah, I think it can be kind of hard to talk about video games moving in a direction Because I guess when I hear that, it kind of feels like, is music all moving in one direction?
Yeah.
When in fact, like, music is like, you have country, you have rock, you have R&B, you have rap and all that. And I think there's just, we're starting to see that happen to video games, where there's clear, how do I call it, like, subcultures starting to develop, and we're all kind of running ourselves now, it seems.
It's like when people talk about animation as just one genre, when it actually is just a thing that exists.
It's a medium.
That's a medium for everything to exist underneath it.
Yeah.
Right. So we
still aren't used to it.
So, I mean, there is this definite surge of procedural generation and things like that, which is something that I'm super excited to see, because it's one of those things that I feel kind of really squeezes a lot of juice out of what video games can do.
Who do you think who is doing it right now that you're looking at? Is anybody doing it?
I mean, in recent years, like, Spelunky is kind of my example that I show people when they want to hear about this stuff. Because, like, it is kind of what Bree's talking about, is that it's this mixture of handcrafted stuff that Moss Mouth made. But the chunks are all hand-authored, but the chunks are all kind of randomly scrambled around so that they're all connected in ways that you're not expecting. So it does have that mixture of, like, really human-made design plus the magic juice that computers can do of calculating things together.
Bree, what games today are using the system stuff you want to see?
No game is doing it the way I want to see it.
Why not?
Why not? Many, many, many reasons. There's, you know, big games, big companies that have the money to put into research like this have big games that can't take big risks because too many jobs depend on it. And then small companies can't take years to try to do something in a new direction, so they need a plan where they incrementally move towards it. But sometimes when something is unknown, you can't make a plan. The other thing is there a will? Like, am I just weird? Is this something that everyone in the industry wants? Probably not. Like, I think, games are pretty awesome, and the achievements that we make, like the amount of thought and tech innovation and everything that goes into the games we make is incredible. And it's the result of the passions of the people in the industry. So if the industry is not moving in a direction that's the direction I want to go, it's because I'm different.
I think there's a part of me that believes that at some point it's going to be a direction that a lot of companies that might have to go in, because at some point, like, the way we're doing things right now is there's very brute force of, let's make a lot of content, a lot of really expensive content that takes a long time to make and really requires a ton of people to make it.
Yes.
And at some point, I'd have to imagine that number of people you'll need just becomes unsustainable.
I agree.
I mean, let's take, I don't know, The Witcher 3.
Yeah.
That is a really big game with tons of content. And we're trying to imagine Witcher 4 as being even bigger and more, Witcher 5 and 6 and 7. And at some point, I'm not sure how they're going to do that.
Episodic?
Sure.
Does it being bigger and bigger and bigger increase the value you're getting out of it? Like, is there a point where just making it bigger no longer makes the experience better? Like, there are other things we should be focused on in improving the experience, like deepening it.
Such as AI, right?
Right, exactly.
Wait, so Bree, same question you guys asked to Brendan. Since you've worked in big AAA studio, what do you see happening in the future with these kinds of titles?
I guess it depends on the title and which direction they want to go in. Like, do they want to improve on story? Do they want to improve on systems? Do they want to go online? Like, there's many different directions they could go. I would like to see a lot more focus, like I kind of mentioned, on the open world and on character. So, like, one of the reasons I moved on to Child of Light from AAA was because I didn't want to work in 3D anymore, because I was kind of annoyed that we focused so much on the environments in 3D and not on the eyes and faces. And so we have now reached a point where we have, like, beautiful, realistic environments, and then we have, like, these dead-looking faces walking around in them. And there's a lot of people fixing that now. And I saw at GDC this year, like, a presentation on believable characters where they had eyes that looked like they looked real. So, but that's a first step. Once you have like realistic eyes and everything, what are those characters doing? And why are they doing what they're doing? And who are they? And what do they want? And what are their hopes and dreams? And can I get to know them?
Bree, you said there's not any games right now that are doing a narrative system a way that you want to, but are there narrative games that you are enjoying right now?
I'm not playing any of the typical, like normally I'm a fan of like open world adventure games. Skyrim is my favorite game, but right now the game I'm playing all the time is just, it's The Simpsons Tapped Out on mobile. I'm playing it a lot. And this game, yeah, it doesn't have any of the kind of narrative stuff that I'm looking to make, except that it, in a way it does. Like I think one reason I like this game is because I do get a lot of story out of it. It has linear story that, like, you know, the game updates itself often and it adds new storylines and I'm progressing in the storylines, but also like the way that I place objects in the world and like why is there a chalk outline in the park, you know, and that creates a little bit of narrative. So that's more of that systemic approach.
If you were in charge of the next Elder Scrolls game, what would you want to focus on?
If I was in charge of the next Elder Scrolls game, I love their games so much, but what I think about Elder Scrolls games is I love creating my character. I love role-playing a character. I love, like, choosing outfits and going on adventures and bringing stuff home and organizing it. And I love crafting and I love leveling up and I love choosing what I level up in. I love choosing what guilds I join. And I love, like, meeting all the characters involved and, like, having alliances or not and, like, but what I really wish is that I could really get to know the characters. And this isn't my own idea. I'm stealing this idea from like a conversation I had once with Felicia Day where she was saying she wished she could get to know the characters more. Like when she sets up her house, who's the neighbor? And can she become friends with the neighbor? And like, can she get to know the neighbor? And like, you know, can you help the neighbor? Can you like get in a fight with the neighbor? Like, where's the social fabric? And so that's what I would put in the game.
So when you're talking about getting to know your neighbors, do you like that better in an open world game where the point of the game is not really to get to know your neighbors? So like it's an option and that makes it better as opposed to like a game where it's all about your neighborhood and getting to know your neighbors?
I don't like being told what to do. You know, like if I remember in high school, like having to read one of my favorite novels one year in English class and I started to hate the book. Because I don't like being told what to do or on what schedule to do it. So if it's a game about having to get to know your neighbors and they've put scores or gamification or something, like some kind of design systems to do with getting to know your neighbors, I think I would hate it. What I like about open world games is that there's so many options and I can express myself through which ones I choose to do and when I feel like doing them. And like, you know, depending on what kind of day I had, and what kind of relaxation I want in the evening, it's probably available in a game like that.
Yeah, I think when people, like, when people say, like, the role-playing game genre, I think that open-world games are the most successful games in that place. Even when an open-world game is not meant, like, intended to be an RPG, I feel that they are the most successful at evoking that. Because when I play them, I have this like very specific Brendan playstyle. Like when I play GTA, I follow every traffic rule and I love it. Because like, I can play it my way. I get to like set up all these little details about my character and no one's telling me how to do it right or how to do it wrong. It's not judging me on it. There's something wonderful about that.
So do you play GTA? Do you follow the rules if you're playing a character that doesn't follow the rules?
I'm sorry, but
do you... So Trevor is a character who does not play by the rules. Are you playing yourself or are you playing as Trevor? Like, will you go out of your way to not follow the rules then when you're playing as Trevor?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that GTA 5 did. Well, one of the more interesting ideas it did, I think, was like when I play Brendan style, it does get boring after a while.
Yeah.
But I felt GTA 5 kind of gave me the permission to not be my character sometimes. I could switch to a different person and like, oh, now I'm this person now. now if I do something that I don't agree with, it's not my fault. It's, you know, the game kind of let me do it. So the answer is no, I blow stuff up.
Are there other games that make you feel like, feel bad for wanting to do your play style? If you're playing as like a certain character?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I think kind of what Bree's talking about, sometimes when a game kind of pushes you to do something and there's kind of a disconnect because like, oh, it wants me to be a bloodthirsty guy when in fact I am kind of the more, you know, do things from a distance and do things very quietly.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a disconnect that I feel sometimes.
In games that ask you to have a choice between doing the good thing or the bad thing, typically we found that people tend to play the good run through first, then do evil after the fact as a like an extra. They don't have to care about anything. Is that how you play?
I know it. I just don't gravitate toward the evil thing at all. In fact, I think they released the numbers for, I think, Fable, I think. And like the numbers were bananas. It was some crazy amount of people who just like never did anything bad. So I don't know. It's kind of funny.
I think I read somewhere that of the stats from some game, the number of people who did the bad option, it was almost always their second playthrough.
Yeah.
Like almost no one does it at first. And so you have to be the kind of person who wants to go do the second playthrough. I think when I have made more than one character in a game, the first character is usually like some version of myself. And then if I finish the game, or if it's possible to finish or whatever, but if I end up creating another character, then at that point it's where I just try something that's like completely different than what I made, like try a melee character or something.
Question for both of you, which is somewhat related to this. Do you prefer to play games as yourself more often than as a different character?
For me, I like to create my character. If there already is a protagonist, then it's a different game for me. So like the silent protagonist, I don't think it's a good compromise. Like if there's going to be one, I'd rather play one. But I prefer to play games where I make my own.
I have a very specific play style, and I like to do that. So I generally do that all the time. Unless, I mean, if the game does make me be a person, then I will try my very best to act as that person. Because it's kind of a fun...
role-playing?
Yeah. It's kind of like... it's telling me to be an actor as opposed to being me. And so it's kind of a different challenge of like, how do I be the most of this character?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a different experience. I read a study... I can't remember whose study it was. They got some teenagers to play Second Life and they studied the relationships between the players and their avatars. And there was they found that like people tended to fall into different groups with their relation to their avatar. Like some people don't care at all what their avatar looks like or how their avatar moves because they see it as a tool to do the things they want to do in a game. Like, oh, I really want to build a bridge. And they like skip the character creator and they build a bridge. Some people like need the avatar to be as much a representation of themselves as they can. So like one guy in that study quit playing because none of the walk cycles were masculine enough. And then there was a third category, which I think is where I fall and where a lot of people I know fall in, which is what Jane McGonigal talks about. And she talks about like using your avatar to become a better person in your life because you create like a version of yourself that's yourself, but with a few things different, like maybe someone you might want to be, like maybe a bit braver or a bit more outgoing or something. And then you play it in the game and then it kind of affects how you are in life.
That's probably just like an aspirational bit of everybody where, you know, if you first meet somebody, you try to put out the best version of yourself. And just, that's a more hands-on version of that, I guess.
Right, yeah, that's a good point. Oh, does that mean you're not fully relaxed in the game?
It is the first, well, those happen, like the first time you're feeling out a game, so it's like a new relationship, right?
Right, yeah, and then so do you become more of a jerk as the game goes on?
Yeah, because you totally, it's...
like leave the toilet seat up and like...
Because then you stop, because then you're feeling out the game's rules, so then by the end of it, you know exactly how relaxed you could be, so you're just sprinting through areas.
Yes. You know how to game the system and the relationship.
Right, yeah.
Wow. You could totally make a game right now. Oh, this is great. I want to go back for a second for Brendan because I forgot to ask this, but you prefer open world but open design games where you can choose more of what you can actually do in your game, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. But your own work are very linear.
Yeah. I mean, I've tried to do a bunch of different things. So yeah. Flotilla was kind of like an exercise in trying out what would kind of random events jumble together. How would that create some sort of storyline?
Yeah.
Atom Zombie Smasher was kind of this systemic thing where zombies are kind of spreading across the country, and you have to kind of manage this spread of this infection. But yeah, with the story stuff I've done on 30 Flights of Loving and Gravity Bone, it has been much more linear, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, I think that for me, I've been trying to explore what can I do with story. Like, Gravity Bone and 30 Flights were kind of what would a story look like if it was 10 minutes long. And I think it's interesting. I think I kind of gravitate more toward the more Dwarf Fortress type of storytelling where you let a system run, and then from that simulation kind of happenstance happens and happy accidents happens. And so I think for future projects, that's kind of the direction I'm going in.
Mm. Is that what Quadrilateral Cowboy is going to be like?
Yeah, I mean, in a way that it is, it tries to take a page from kind of the immersive sim genre where you're let loose in this kind of sandbox level, and then your tools just work, and how you want to use them is up to you. And everything's kind of physically simulated, so when you play it, things will happen that I am not intending, and I think there's something kind of magical about this.
Is there a predefined ending, or is it changing as you play?
Oh, you mean the ending of the game? No, yeah. I mean, so I usually try to do one thing with each game that I do. Atom Zombie Smasher was about, let's try to make an RTS and see how Brendan does that. 30 Flights was like, let's try doing a short story. And this one is all about, let's try making fun toys to play with. And so for me, I kind of focus just on that. Uh-huh. And I do have some story, but it's not. I feel that I know my limits. So the story's just it's pretty straightforward.
And this is a pretty dumb question, because 30 Flights is designed to be a 10-minute game, but is there an ideal way that you could make like a 6-hour AAA 30 Flights of Loving?
6-hour AAA 30 Flights of Loving.
What would the AAA remake of 30 Flights of Loving be like?
Yeah. Lots of normal maps, lots of specular maps, lots of really high poly models.
You actually see the heist or whatever happened.
Yeah. No stone left unturned.
An ideal version, like not saying like the normal one would be like you control the shootout at the end. But it's an ideal AAA version that would not just be up to assets.
I think you kind of hear the word like cinematic being used a lot of times. It's like, oh, this game is so cinematic. It feels like you're playing a movie. And I feel that sometimes games kind of take that movie structure and try to stretch it out to 6-8 hours. And I feel that for me, what I find would be more interesting is if games kind of took the television format instead. Because games and television kind of have a lot of overlap in that, and books, in that you kind of have this blank check on how long your thing can be. Whereas movies, it's basically, it could only be like 2 hours, 3 hours. So what I'd be interested in seeing is kind of, what if it was a bunch of episodes, but then through the episodes,
there's like an arc, like The Good Wife.
Like The Good Wife, exactly like that. Yeah, so yeah, there's this through line that you follow. So I mean, that's what I would be interested in, I think.
That's a great idea.
You are seeing a lot of games do that now. Like Metal Gear is very much all about episode numbers and breaking things up. And then Telltale's doing TV now and Quantum
Break, Quantum Leap, the new Remedy game.
Oh, right.
I think Quantum Leap's a TV show.
Yeah, Quantum Leap's a TV show.
It's going to take people being brave, right? Because there's, like, if you don't put 40 hours in a full-priced game, then people are, like, maybe the market wants it, but reviewers don't, or vice versa, or how do we know? And then if we go at a different price point, then there's uncertainties, and it's hard to predict profitability. Like, it takes someone who really believes in it and can push through like all of the process and structure that's already in place.
Yeah, there's a lot of unknowns there. And so I can kind of understand why someone hasn't like gone gung-ho on it yet.
But it's a better idea. Like who I don't have 40 hours. Or if I do, they're in 1 hour blocks and then I kind of forget what happened last time. And so, I mean, there's a reason that this structure developed on TV.
Yeah. And I would love just to have like a 2-hour game experience, but this is endlessly replayable.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping when Portal 1 came out, I was kind of hoping that would be this kind of sea change and like, oh, people kind of love or really, people will go for a 2-hour thing.
Why do you think it didn't spawn a sea change?
I mean, just from my personal experience getting emails from people, is that people equate length with
the cost.
Right. Like people have broken down my games compared to Call of Duty, and like, I got so and so dollars out of Call of Duty and so and so out of your game, and doesn't add up, Brendan. And I think that they're not. I think that's a valid way of seeing it. That is a perspective.
It's not the only way.
Yeah, but I think for people like me, and it sounds like you, Bree, is that we do want games that don't take, you know, a month or 2 months to finish.
Right, so what is it? What is it that we're looking for in a game? Like, what is a worthwhile... Like, what am I trying to say? But... I have trouble reading novels now because my attention span has gotten really bad. If I'm stuck on an airplane, it's about the only time I can read a novel. I'm trying to improve this. But when I actually manage to do it, I'll get so much insight into life and realize that I'm thinking about everything from one angle and there could be this other angle and then maybe these things are actually okay and these things aren't and whatever. I get perspective and other people's opinions, and I feel like empathy and walking in other people's shoes, and like you just get a lot of like understanding about other people and life and what it is to be human. And you know, that's if that doesn't relate to the time spent in a game, I don't think. And can games give you that feeling?
That's what you're looking for when you play games.
Maybe.
Well, you're trying to think of like why do most people. Where do they equate with value with what they're looking for in a game? And most of the time it's just time that they get.
It's like, is it time spent? Because then Netflix is a really good value, right?
Yes.
Like I spend every night with Netflix and I think I pay $8 a month or something.
We still have like people pissed about RPGs getting not 60 hours anymore or games that aren't.
Over 100 hour RPGs from like 20 years ago.
But if the open world had strong enough systems, how do you measure the time? What if an open world game came out without a main quest?
What?
What is that?
It would be in Steam Greenlight forever.
Would it?
I don't know how much you would price.
That just blew my mind. I never even thought about a game that could be like that.
Well, because the main quest in an open world game always drives me crazy. Why would I do any of the side content? Like, if I'm really role-playing the character, think in Skyrim, like, dragons are attacking people's homes. Why would I go and pick flowers and learn alchemy? I kind of need to deal with these dragons. So I always do the main quest first, just because otherwise I feel guilty.
Yeah.
but then I don't really want to do it. If you think of storytelling through your systems, stories, like the things you want to convey to the player, will emerge as they play through the open world, whether they're playing a main quest or not. Like, one of my favorite things in Bethesda games is, like, it's always like a gray area. Like, you think there's a good guy and a bad guy, but then as you get further involved with either side, you realize it's not quite so clear, and then you've actually, like, meant to be the good guy, but now you've done a bad thing, and, like, that's what that's about. And that doesn't need to be in the main quest.
Yeah, yeah. People usually, at least with the Elder Scrolls games, people always talk about these side quests, like the Dark Brotherhood or part of the guilds. They mentioned that, but they never, ever talk about the main quests.
Right.
That's more just like, it's an obligation to...
Like, so we put the main quest in what, to sell the game?
Yes, and side quests where you can experiment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think for me, whenever I play an open world game, the main quest always feels... It always feels like a disconnect there for me. It feels like there's two games sometimes in that I have this giant sprawling world, and then I do a campaign mission, and then I'm kind of locked into doing this. What kind of feels to me oftentimes like a more traditional shooting game where, like, you go down this hallway, hit this thing, get this suitcase, whatever it is. And then it just, like, doesn't take advantage of the fact that I have this giant simulated detailed world to play with. And instead I'm kind of doing these very directed experiences. And my best guess is that it's just kind of a vestigial remnant of the way games traditionally work, and that you start a level, you have an objective, you do it, and then, you know, you move on to the next level. And I guess that's just a structure.
So say you create an open world game that doesn't have that main quest, and someone who's not very familiar with games drops in, buys that game. How should that game start for them? You can't just drop them in the world and be like, do whatever you want. They don't even know how to use a controller.
I mean, you can.
Can you?
Yeah.
Is it a good idea?
Yeah.
It's like sink or swim. It's like throwing your kid in the lake at the deep end, and that's how they learn to swim.
With Journey, though, if you give it to someone who has never played games before, it's still really hard for them to get used to what to do, especially with camera control.
Yeah, I had a woman, a friend of mine, tell me that she found the controls in Child of Light too hard, and that's why she stopped playing. And as a gamer my whole life, I was surprised that I didn't think of the controls in Child of Light as being hard, like walking back and forth. And then there's the fighting sequences, but it's the fighting sequences because you're controlling more than one character. And if you haven't spent 10 years like knowing the language of the controller, it's really confusing.
Or the language of games themselves and how they're supposed to work or mechanics generally right. Run.
But I'm still thinking about this theoretical game, how you would start a game. But I think you would still have to, you need to separate a person who's never played games before with just a person who's coming to this world for the first time. I guess start with a small area that expands to the big one. That's easy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, The Witcher basically did this.
Yeah.
Do you remember the beginning of Oblivion?
You're in the jail cell. Patrick Stewart comes up to you and tells you he's the king and he's going to die.
And then the first part is very linear, and then you come out of the whatever.
The sewer tunnel outside of the open world.
Yeah. And then it's like, tells you, basically all you know is that you need to walk west, and then they just happen to put a sunset.
Oh, that was so great.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
But I feel like that kind of beginning could be good.
Yes.
That's why I like Journey so much, is how it doesn't tell you just, where should I go? Oh, there's that one mountain I can see all the time. I should probably go to that.
Mm-hmm. So after this podcast is over, we will be having design discussions about this second game.
I feel like we should probably ask at some point, hey, Brendan, what's your background in narrative?
Yeah. I mean, I started just making small mods and stuff for Doom and Quake and Half-Life. But I mean, for those, So I grew up playing the old LucasArts games and the old Sierra adventure games, like Heroes Quest and Police Quest and all those. And so when I learned that I could make my own first-person stuff in elementary school, I was like, oh, I'm going to make a Sierra game type of thing in Doom. And it was very challenging, and I basically could not do it because the only tools I had were you know, shoot with shotgun, and that was the verb that I could do. And so I basically kept trying to do that, and I think a decade later, I finally made Gravity Bone, which is kind of finally started to touch on things that I was interested in doing. It was like, what if you made a first-person game that was not about shooting? What if it was about taking pictures and doing spy things and, you know, being this sneaky person? And I think from that, yeah. And then after that, I just started Blendo Games. And so I'm just going to do whatever weird things I got to try now.
And you also went to school for film?
I did, yeah. I was interested in doing video games, but there was not anything video game related. So I figured, why not study something I am really interested in knowing more about and, you know, want to do. Yeah, so I did a bunch of goofy video projects in UC San Diego, just running around making short films.
Are you going to adapt any of your games into movies?
You know what? I love movies, and I love that whole world. my thing is that I also love, this is going to sound kind of like a mercenary, but I like being able to feed myself and having a roof over my head, and I don't know how to make money off of making movies. I know how to do that off of video games, because I can just put it on Steam. But like,
once what you
I,
do?
I was just games? I was just like, oh, maybe you can teach me.
I have a rough idea. I'll say that it's a better idea than making movies, I guess. So yeah, that's kind of the big reasons why.
You just explained like our whole like moving out from film into video games because it is easier to make money. It is baseline easier. Not easy.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I'll say that. Yeah.
Holy shit, it's not easy. But is there a huge story bible for the Citizen Able universe?
There is a doc of really rough dates and places and locations and, you know, soda brands and stuff like that.
There's a brand bible for the Citizen Able universe?
There is. It's my favorite page. yeah. I mean, I personally don't care too much about canon. I think canon just kind of slows things down and makes things harder to make. But for me, it's more of an emergency grab bag. If I like, oh, I want to do something, but I'm not sure what, and then you peek in there for 2 seconds and you find something instantly.
And Quadrilateral Cowboy is in the universe.
Yeah.
It's, why?
I'm sorry. What?
Why is it in the universe? If you don't like, you don't care that much about canon.
Uh huh.
And just. Why are you still using it?
Is it just because you don't care?
Oh, so why do it in the universe even if I don't care?
Yeah.
Because I made the place and I love it. It's my little baby. Yeah.
That's great.
I can't let go of it.
Could you describe to somebody who does not know anything about the Citizen Able universe what it is?
Yeah, it's not on Earth. So I try to be careful not to refer to any like real locations. I think I messed up a few times, but that's my goal. And it's in a roughly South American place called Nuevos Aires. There's lots of government bureaucracy. There's lots of spy work, lots of surveillance. There's lots of really colorful criminals. It's kind of whatever I need it to be for that game. Like, I made Flotilla, and therefore they had space travel in 1968. it just was convenient. So basically every game that I make just adds more things to this universe.
Makes it more crazy and impossible sounding.
Yes.
It's not on Earth. Was doesn't matter at all. It's not on Earth. It could be anything.
You know what? I don't know. I just doesn't.
You're not criticizing this.
I am not criticizing your universe.
No. But there's something about it when it takes place on Earth, but it doesn't. I don't know. There's a disconnect there for me because like I feel that if it did take place on Earth, then I should know about it. But since it's fictional, I can't go and find more about it.
That's really good.
It doesn't make sense.
I'm going to steal that reasoning from something original. We're looking at our next question, Bree.
I have this image in my mind of people from all over the continent moving to Montreal to try to make it in the video game industry, and you go out for dinner and the person serving you is trying to sell you their game design idea, it's harder to make movies than it is.
You're just describing like the video game version of Hollywood where everyone's working out
their I got this game idea, man.
Yeah, exactly.
They're all working at their coffee shops, and then at night coding. Their voiceover.
Yeah, people bringing their laptops into Starbucks all the time.
Let me show you my source code. It's really good. Trust me.
Everyone's got their source code with them.
We got to sign the source code to WME.
Got this hot new game jam coming out. All these like no name film festivals, all these game jams keeps propping up, and no name.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, that would be
the game jam part. Yes.
This is not, there's no transition for this question, but Brie, do you think that writers or people working in narrative should know about programming or game design or anything other than writing in video games?
And vice versa with the rest of the team knowing about narrative.
Yeah, like should level designers know more about narrative? Would that help them if the team is making a story-based game?
I have two answers. The first answer I would say yes. The more you know about the constraints and possibilities on other parts of the team, the more you can exploit that and come up with really great stuff and be efficient. But I think my answer is actually no, because when you know too much and you work within what you think are the constraints, you're probably not going to have crazy new ideas. If you don't know anything, if you come from outside the industry and you don't know what's possible or not, you're going to push for things that people at first are going to say, no, that's not possible for such and such reason, but you'll probably find a way to get at least a few of those things made and push the industry forward. So I think it's more interesting when it's like a tension between what you know and don't know.
Potentially more interesting, also potentially more wasteful in terms of money.
Yes. Yeah, I guess there's more risk. Yeah. So, but then there's a chance for greater reward. My favorite game when I was little was Colonel's Bequest. Similar to some of the games Brendan mentioned, it was by Roberta Williams and using the King's Quest engine. And from what I understand, I think it was sort of, at the time, LucasArts was making really great games and Sierra was working on a new engine, and they were like, just do whatever you want with this engine because we can't compete right now. So they made this game that's all character and story based, and the writer was from outside the industry, so she didn't know what was possible in games, and I think what they achieved is super interesting.
Yeah, I think kind of related was at Pandemic, we used to kind of segregate the design pit and the programmer pit and the art pit. But then for later projects, we started just mixing artists next to designers, next to programmers, and kind of like having a hodgepodge of people put together. And what happened was that something really cool happened was that, you know, artists would come over to talk to the other artists, but then the designers and programmers would kind of gleam off of that and kind of like hear words here and there. And then you kind of got this kind of mishmash of like information that really made, I think, all of our, you know, it made all of us a lot richer, I believe.
So then as a one person studio, do you think you know too much?
I don't have anyone else to do other tasks for me. So I don't have any choice in this.
Do you wish that you could like unlearn some of the things you know, though?
Yeah. I mean, I think I do sometimes feel that, like when we were talking earlier about like having the controller be hard for a non-gamer to play, I do sometimes feel that I am making video games for my game developer friends. And I think that can be kind of dangerous because you're just stuck in this echo chamber of like, oh, I like your stuff. You like my stuff. And then just kind of like circles back over and over again. And like the work you'll end up making is kind of limited, I think.
Niche of a niche.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you're like super knowledgeable about video games.
Just inside baseball, the game.
Yeah. And I think there is, like, when you're talking about Colonel's Bequest and bringing in someone who has not done video games, I think Colonel's Bequest would not be possible without that.
I think there's more than one way to approach innovation. Like, it's not just sort of like do this one thing and you're going to innovate. So, like, having some people on the team from outside the industry can be one way, but I like, you know, games made by experts for experts, like games about games. Like, that's another way to push the industry forward. Like, you've thought about something for many years, very deep, deep understanding, deep knowledge, and you have something to say about it, and it's going to change the industry also.
And to go back to the question, I'm just curious, at Ubisoft, how were the people working there, were they just more individualized jobs where people only knew how to perform their job really well, or were they more rounded, or did it change based on like what department you were in?
At Ubisoft, each project runs like its own company, sort of. So the company culture like varies from project to project, and the processes and the engine and everything varies. But in general, on a giant AAA production, it's many, many people. It's hundreds of people. So each person becomes an extreme specialist in one thing. On some teams I've worked on, they sat in silos, like all the artists sitting in one part of the floor and all the programmers in another. On other projects, that we've sat mixed based on like which feature you're working on. But still, like, each person is doing one thing, like animating an animal for a very long time, getting it perfect. And, sorry, what was the question again?
It was just like, do the people working at Ubisoft, from what you've experienced, do they know more about like other jobs that aren't their own?
Right. So when I was working on those big teams, I didn't even know I didn't really know what the art team did or what tools they used or what their process was or what their schedule was. Like, I knew my things that I needed to know. And still, I was in connection with, you know, at least 100 people, like, just to do my part of the game. But there were many parts of the team. I had no idea how they ran or what they did. It was like magic to me. That's why moving on to Child of Light was really wonderful to kind of round that out, because I thought when I moved on to Child of Light that it would be easier because it was a much smaller production, much less complex, much less to coordinate. But it wasn't easier. I had a lot to learn. I had to learn about every part of what goes into a game, how it works, what tools we use, how they work, what order things need to be done in, what things can be done iteratively, what things can't. Like, working on that smaller production was much harder. It required me to learn a lot more, to understand a lot more. And it was more fun, in my opinion.
So, insert segue here, but games are still incredibly young as a medium, and we're still figuring out what the language is. This is kind of a ridiculous question because of how you can't define what we don't know yet, but what have we figured out how to say yet with video games? Or what experiences are we having trouble conveying?
How many games are about comedy? Like, are there? Maybe I'm just missing some, but like, when I watch movies, I often like to watch like really dumb comedies. Are there games like
Leisure Suit Larry?
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yes.
I mean, you have like Jazz Punk. You have like
The
One Lives Forever, which is very kind of was a very good game.
Action comedy.
And it was one of the rare games that tried to, you know, make a really funny FPS game.
Can you use game mechanics to convey comedy? Is that possible?
WarioWare?
Yes. Yeah, there you go.
But yeah, I mean, you're definitely right with that. This is like an approach that not many games take.
Because comedy is really hard.
Comedy is not easy to do.
It's like, so, why aren't more games funny? Even when they try, why aren't they funny?
But even using gameplay as a comedic device, WarioWare is the only one I can think of that really, besides like doing one-off jokes that are based around,
I mean, like Portal kind of did, acknowledging gameplay mechanics and tropes. But it was funny.
Yes.
Yeah, like right now I'm playing a game called Home Improvisation, which is a game about building IKEA furniture. But the gag is you can connect the pieces in any configuration you want. And the other gag is it's also multiplayer. So you have like three people trying to like connect this lamp to this thing and then drilling holes in this thing to attach this thing to this. And it is hilarious.
All at the same time?
Yeah, at the same time. It's pretty
good. Are there instructions inside the game?
I don't think so.
Because it would be hilarious if they were like impossible to read.
Oh, yeah. That would be great.
Is it physics-based?
It is, yes. And physics is always hilarious, I think.
Yes.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I mean, it is hard to do, but you would imagine that people like funny things, so why don't we make more of it?
I mean, you do have humor in your games, Brendan. Like, humor's kind of a big thing. It's not the main thing in your games, but a lot of your games have humor. Why?
There are some, like, movies that I watch, and whenever they are devoid of any humor, it's like, you know, the world is in trouble. We have to deal with it. Whenever there's no jokes, it just doesn't feel human to me. It feels like it's a movie. It feels like they don't feel like human beings. They feel like characters saying lines. Because I feel that people are just this weird grab bag of things. People are serious. People are funny. People can be a lot of things. And when you just remove chunks of personality from people, the game just doesn't feel alive to me.
So you're never going to make a serious game, quote unquote serious game?
I have every intention to do that, but I think that even when you are serious, you can't have no humor in it.
Yeah,
I feel it just doesn't feel right.
That was a good follow-up, but I still want to hear your answer to the question, because Bree's answer was really good about she wants to see comedy, or like establishing what language we need to still find out with games. What do you think?
The question that we asked like 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we are very good at showing conflict and physical disagreements with people. But I think that anything outside of that needs a lot of work.
Very good at doing relationships.
Just anything regarding human beings in general, I think. That's outside of armed guns and, you know, putting bullets into people. That's something that's super challenging and super hard to do. So yeah, whenever I do see games that, like, try to play with that or kind of noodle with it, I get super excited because that's something that, you know, that's something that I want to see more done.
The games industry, I think that we're kind of in a loop. Like, there's not much diversity in the workforce, and we make a handful of types of games mostly centered on this one, like, stimulating violence thing. And people who love that come to work in the games industry, and those games are great. And they love them, and they make games like that. And I feel like, which comes first, the chicken or the egg, but if we could attract a wider range of people into the industry to make a wider range of games, or make a wider range of games to attract a wider range of people. But, you know, there's so much we can do with interactivity besides this, I think.
Yeah, and then you see that there are people who want that. Like, if you look at Gone Home, that is right. A wonderful game that people really love, and it's great. And but like, how do you move kind of the larger game industry to kind of explore that space? And I'm not quite sure how.
You have one of those games make a lot of money,
but then that happens in the film industry, and the excuse is like, oh, that's a one-off. Like, Inception was a wildly successful, creative, original idea, but no.
I think maybe that there's hope for the games industry, though, because, like, games are very expensive and complex to make, but it's becoming less and less so as the industry matures, as a industry, as the tools mature, as software development matures, and we have things like Unity and Unreal. And, like, with young people growing up with games around them all the time, if they can be exposed to things like game jams and see that they can make their ideas, maybe things could change.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I think maybe it is just a matter of time, because I think that the smaller games that are being made now are exploring interesting spaces. So maybe the people who are playing them now, when they become of age to enter the industry, mm-hmm. maybe we'll see some sort of, you know, gradual movement.
Maybe. I don't think it will for sure happen. Like, I think there has to be certain conditions. And the reason I think this, because I've done a lot of research about this in the past year or so, and one of the things I found that's super inspiring and super not inspiring at once is at Harvey Mudd College, they made 3 changes to their computer science program, and they increased they were targeting gender diversity specifically, so they made changes to attract more women, 3 changes, and they increased their enrollment in just a few years from less than 8% women to more than 40%.
Wow.
In computer science, and the changes were just to offer an actual introductory class instead of having a class that was called introduction, but was actually assuming that you already knew how to do all this stuff. So they have a real introductory class where it doesn't make any assumptions about what you know. And then they have, like, over the summer, you can do a project where you can actually see what you can do with programming. So you can see, like, a concrete result instead of just learning all these abstract algorithms and stuff. And they send promising women from their first year class to the Grace Hopper Conference so that they can see older women in the field, just so that they have a visualization of what it might look like to be a woman computer programmer. And that Harvey Mudd took those steps from a study from another university whose name I'm blanking on right now, but it's being rolled out in 15 other schools. But it's such a small change that caused such a huge difference. So it's inspiring, but it's also depressing that it, like, if we were that close this whole time, but we just, like, that's crazy.
And a lot of industries have a thing, like, where they're entrenched in certain ideas, it ends up being, we have to wait for these people to die or leave their jobs for things to change.
Right.
On a lighter note,
Brendan, in old interviews, you have said that you skip all cutscenes in a game and all text whenever you can. Do you still do this?
I try not to, but whenever I do, I feel a pang of guilt. Because, I mean, I feel that, it's a mixture of things, right? Because on one hand, I feel like the reason why I skip them is because I don't feel it's adding much to the game, or it doesn't make sense, or it just kind of feels like it's just taking up time. But then when I do skip them for those reasons, I feel like I'm not getting the full experience of this thing. It's like, what if I was reading a book and took out all the vowels because I don't like vowels. It's like, oh, I ruined it for myself.
How the early Bible was written.
Not going to cut that out.
So what makes you want to use cutscenes in your games? Because, like, 30 Flights of Eleven has very brief cutscenes when you're showing the background of the characters.
Yeah. And I felt...
Did you feel dirty using them?
I felt mega dirty, yes. That's the
answer. Is that just you not figuring out a way to integrate that with the gameplay?
Well, it was better than the alternative. Because the earlier version had dialogue. Uh-huh. And they said lines to you. And writing is really hard to do. And just the lines just never sounded right. So I needed to find a way to do it without them saying, you know, their goofy line. And this was the better way of doing it. So from that perspective, I don't feel that bad. But yeah, I rationalize it to myself because it's short. Therefore, I'm only taking, you know, 2 seconds out of your life.
Did that warm you to using cutscenes more in the future? Or are you like, never again.
I don't think cutscenes are evil. I think that when people say they don't like something, what they mean to say is they don't like when that thing is done poorly.
Yeah.
They don't like something about it.
Yeah. It's like, if you don't like a genre of something, I think it's more of that you don't like the things that are out there right now, but there is a version of that that you might like, and mm-hmm. it's just waiting to be made. So I think for cutscenes, I think that there are good ways of doing it. And I think you do see that.
Do you ever skip cutscenes?
Yeah, all the time. If I'm playing the game and I'm enjoying the gameplay, and it's like a story that I haven't touched the game in 2 weeks and I kind of forget the story anyway, and then a cutscene starts, it's like two old dudes that I don't really care about. Yeah, I totally skip it. And then I get really confused about why I'm doing what I'm doing. And then I'm like, I ruined this for myself. But it's like, it's not natural to watch a cutscene when you're in the middle of like using your hands on a controller, do this cool thing and you're having fun. And then like, break the experience, do this cutscene. But there, like, that doesn't mean there shouldn't, like, there needs to be a way to convey this character development and stuff, but maybe there are ways to do it without taking control away, or taking control away in a way that doesn't feel jarring, or like just maybe identifying in those moments what feels jarring to the player and why the player has a feeling like skipping, and trying to fix those problems.
Yeah.
I never understood, like, there's some things about the games industry that I didn't understand at first until I worked there for a while. And like, I remember when Warcraft 3 came out, like the RTS, and in between, like when you do the single player campaign, and in between some of them, they had these at the time were just like amazing cutscenes. Like there would be like hairs moving on the fur on the shoulder of this guy, like he's wearing a fur on his shoulder or whatever. But at the time, like I was like, okay, that looks really cool, but I don't understand why it's in the game. Like, it looks different than the game. It's like, it's not using the same engine. Like, it's a pre-rendered thing. Like, to me, it didn't make sense. Like, why are these little movie scenes in between? But I know that, like, for many other people, it makes sense.
This is another question you might delete, because I was reading this essay on the internet like a minute before we started this podcast, and the author believes that narrative is not a game mechanic, it is a form of feedback. The way he explains,
I think that maybe narrative is a reward.
Isn't a word?
A reward. Oh. Sorry, I'm not near this near the microphone. A reward. Like if we're talking about getting story from the systems.
Yeah.
Then in that case it's a reward. Like you're interacting with the systems and then you have a story to tell your friend the next day.
That's how he was going through it.
Okay.
Reddit.
I don't quite understand the premise, is it?
He was like explaining like the most basic form of narrative in a game is like a choose your own adventure story, where the narrative is what gives you the reason for playing it, and then every choice you make, you're rewarded with more narrative. And so then that forms a feedback. And then he went into like Batman Arkham City, or the opening of the game is you go up to the side of a building and then you're rewarded with a video of the Joker threatening Gotham City. And then after that, there's a QuickTime event of an explosion going off and they're rewarded again with a cinematic.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a very time-tested way of doing it. Here's gameplay and then here's a little nugget of story to keep you going to the next gameplay chunk. But like when I think of games that I think do interesting things with stories, like I think XCOM and Dwarf Fortress are kind of interesting games that play with what story can be in a game. And I think that in those cases, story doesn't feel like a reward. It feels like something that is just a byproduct of the gameplay.
How does it play with it in XCOM?
Oh my god. Because it had a sniper called Abraham Lincoln that I brought to every corner of the map. And then he was down to 2 health
on
multiple occasions, and it was fantastic. But, like, it doesn't feel... Because, like, I guess when I think of the word reward, I think of it's this little treasure chest that the creator developer makes.
Right, and I think that's where we fail. Like, if we think of, like, you know, like, an objective, and then you have a difficulty to achieve it, and then you achieve it, and you get a reward from the, like, the game loop or from the game designer, that's where we end up with these cutscenes that people want to skip.
Yeah.
Because the reward for story needs to be intrinsic. Like, it needs to be, you want to know more about this thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you find out.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the game should just kind of propel itself. Like, I want to play it because I want to play it. yeah, that's where I'm at on that.
I'm trying to think of, like, what are the hugest problems with the industry trying to do that besides just not enough people wanting to do it. Like, as a, like, game mechanics, like, why is that really hard to do?
You mean, like, systemic?
Yeah.
I mean, I see more games that try to do that every day. That sort of feels like, at least to me, or at least maybe I'm just more conscious about it. But, like, with the resurgence of kind of roguelikes, and I feel that that is the genre that kind of, for me, encapsulates, like, super, just nothing but systemic gameplay. Mm. And I think we're going to see more and more of that.
Yeah, like Shadow of Mordor.
I think so,
too. Yeah, totally. And, like, that is a game that, you know, was kind of traditional video game in a lot of ways, but then it added this system that just made it incredible, in my opinion.
Were you going to say something, Brie? Did I cut you off?
Just a lot of yes, and I agree, and I think this is a great conversation.
Brie, do you play games? Do you go in wanting to play a game because of its story?
I don't think that games are telling the kind of stories I'm interested in, me personally. Uh-huh.
So no. Or
no,
not right now.
No. No. I just finished The Good Wife and I'm looking for something else.
So if you know
of something like that, yeah, no.
Brendan, do you go into games looking for a story? Or do you search out for games based on a good story?
I mean, not... I guess it depends on how you look at it. Like, are there some games that I look for because I think their writing is really good? I think occasionally, yes. Like, I think the Walking Dead team did really good stuff with their game. So once I find out who made it, then I kind of latch on to whatever they do next.
So you're more attached to the creators of seeing?
I guess so.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, like, they're working on Firewatch right now, so I want to know more about Firewatch now.
Yeah.
I think from the other angle, if you think of story as more systemic things, then that kind of gravitates me more toward games that try to laser focus on nothing but systems. Like, I've been playing a lot of Prison Architect lately, and Prison Architect is this really, really good, just super detailed simulation of a prison, and just the way that all these systems just layer on top of each other just creates all sorts of situations, and it's really good.
What was the story of your prison right now?
The story of my prison right now is that the gangs are on the rise and I don't know how to handle it. my administration is a scrambling and it's bad news.
Wow.
I think one thing, I have two thoughts on what you're saying. One is, when we use systems to tell stories, we have to be cognizant of what rules and what assumptions we're building into the system, because that's the story we're going to tell. Hmm. So, like, how SimCity... SimCity is a story of sprawl, and The Sims is a story of capitalism or consumerism. And, like, I don't, like, if you just build your own assumptions into a system, because as a programmer, like, you think you're making a cool system, you don't think it further than that, you're going to reflect your assumptions, which is one way to create art. Like, it's going to say something. But I'd rather say something hopeful or like purposeful critique or something, and so thought needs to go into the rules of the system about that. And then the other thing I just wanted to say is I think that you could make a really good systemic game that tells the story of the good wife, because her story is basically like she has all these morals and values, and then she's put in all these situations that really test them, and it's like there's no good solution. She always kind of finds one without being a pushover, but without doing the bad thing. Like, it's, I think you could do that with systems.
Confirmed on this podcast, Brie Code is working on the Good Wife game.
I wish. No.
So, kind of related, but if, like, when you're playing a game, for both of you, if like the narrative falls completely flat, do you still think of it as a good game?
I think it depends on what the game is trying to be.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, I mean, if it's trying to be narrative and the narrative doesn't work, then yeah, sure.
Unless someone else on the team managed to get something in there that's really cool.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. Definitely.
Thing about games is many people work on them and they're built on many things. Well, not all games many people work on. We're here with Brendan, but in general, different people take different things out of the same game. Like we were talking about open world games, and like Brendan's following all the rules in GTA, and you know, I learned pretty quick not to use Skyrim as a reference for when I'm trying to describe certain things in games, because it means so many different things to so many people. So I'm not sure that the narrative completely falling flat, that there's probably way more things in the game to take. And what does it mean to completely fall flat? Maybe someone likes it.
True.
Now I'm just being wishy-washy, though.
I think for me, it's a little bit... I think when I was younger, I used to be very reactionary to games. Like, oh, this game is the worst. What were they thinking? But then having gone through the process, you kind of learned that people don't go into games wanting to make a bad game. Like, everyone goes in wanting to make something good and special and people remember.
As much as the internet likes to think otherwise.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's like, oh, it's a money grab. It's like, no, this is not the way to make money.
Don't worry, they know all about what the problems of the game are.
And so, like, you learn that, you know, there are just circumstances that are sometimes out of control, or things that just happen, or just the process, for whatever reason, just didn't. The stars just didn't line up for you this time.
Yeah.
So whenever a game comes out that doesn't quite, you know, reach its potential, I have a lot of sympathy for them.
And we're all gonna probably have some of those that we've made in our careers. Like if we're working on stuff that's trying to push things forward, there's an inherent risk in that, and it means sometimes it's not gonna work out.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Definitely.
Brendan. 30 Flights of Loving and Gravity Bone, those are your most recent games. But they're very much steeped in environmental storytelling. What do you like about environmental storytelling?
I like that it conveys information in a way that I can still keep my fingers on WASD and my hand on the mouse. I like still being able to play... I like not having pauses in my gameplay. I think that sounds kind of simple, but I think it kind of ends up becoming a much bigger thing when you do kind of enter that state of mind where you realize, oh, there are moments where I can not pay attention. And that kind of puts you in a mindset of this game has parts where I can ignore if I wanted to. And that just kind of, it just doesn't sit well with me.
It feels like bigger studios are warming up to environmental storytelling a lot more as a device, but it also feels like it might be getting overused a bit, like audio tapes, or just at certain points you'll encounter like an audio tape or environmental storytelling and you just wonder, why would you be recording or writing this right now? Why...
Why would you spray paint this warning
that you're dying?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are many ways to skin a cat, and that is one of them. Personally, for me, I try to be as humanly careful as I can to make sure that everything makes sense and that you can kind of like recreate a timeline of what happened here, and that timeline doesn't include them doing things that, you know, I'm going to record a log while a monster is eating my organs, which doesn't...
That conveniently starts right when it happens.
Yeah, right.
Sure. Some of these things might just become conventions that we get used to and no longer pull us out of the experience. Like, we have these in movies, right? Like, no one says goodbye on the phone in a movie. And, like, during opening scenes, there'll be a lot of, like, last time we talked, no. Like, and just, like, no one would ever speak that way. Yeah. But we're used to it because they need to catch us up on the story.
Yeah, and, like, and speaking of conventions, like, I feel like silent protagonists is a very video game convention where in a movie or, like, a book, that would really draw you out, but we're so used to them in games that it does not feel awkward at all.
Can you imagine a book that's written, like, you walk to the store. You pick up a book. A thought enters your mind.
Or someone has a conversation with you and you don't respond. they act like you did.
That's right, Gordon. Did you, like...
Wait, so, no, so Brendan...
Okay.
What does having a silent protagonist do for you in your games?
For me in my games?
Yeah. And then I have a follow-up question for both of you.
Well, I do it because I don't have any dialogue in my games. Everyone in my games talks with a Charlie Brown wah-wah-wah noise. Saying that right now, I do kind of... It does make sense that I can make a protagonist...
Talk wah-wah-wah.
Yes, exactly. And then the player will kind of fill it in, which actually might, you know, work, I think.
Could you just have, like, I want you to put, like, a radial menu with, like, different wahs. They're all written the exact same way, but you have to choose which one you think is the right.
It's like a BioWare dialogue tree.
That's great. Yeah. I like that a lot. Yeah.
Bree, so, do you have any thoughts on silent protagonists?
Well, I was just surprised when you referred to protagonists in Brendan's game as silent, even though, yes, he has, like, when I played 30 Flights of Loving, I get a real sense of who that character is. Like, there's no talking in the world, so... But in the language of that world, I didn't find the character to be, you know, like, I think when I hear silent protagonist, I'm thinking a lot of, for a long time in the industry and at some teams I was on, we wanted the protagonist to be a blank slate so that people could project themselves into it. And I don't like this idea of the protagonist as a blank slate.
What I would think, like, a blank slate version would be good for is if the game then responds and the character becomes a personality through the way you play it, then. Like, it starts out as a blank slate just so you...
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, starts out as a blank slate and then becomes how you play. Super interesting.
Yeah.
I think, like, you know, the protagonist is there. The protagonist is a person and the world should react to the protagonist and the player should understand who the protagonist is, whether it's themselves or someone else.
So, Bree, when you played Half-Life 2, and, like, all, like, the dialogue scene inside the lab before you get teleported, were you just jumping around as Gordon and not looking at the doctor when he was talking to you and throwing stuff around the laboratory?
I didn't play Half-Life 2.
All right. Brendan, did you do that? I'll come back to you, Bree.
Yes. Yes, I did.
Do you feel disconnected with that? When they're not acknowledging what you're doing?
So what happens is when I start playing a game, I am super into following every rule that it has for me. So it's like, I am a scientist, therefore I am going to listen to you. But then as the game goes on, that kind of degrades. It's like, oh, I'm just going to become a person that just wants to throw physics objects around.
That's like our relationship discussion earlier.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. The relationship just kind of morphs.
We're casual now.
Exactly.
Does it degrade for you because the world is not alive enough? And so the role play becomes boring because the world's not participating in your role playing?
Yeah, because, like, whatever I do, it doesn't really matter. Like, if I play the role perfectly, it doesn't matter if I do that or if I throw a monitor at Dr. Kleiner's head.
But you would feel bad if he yelled at you and you wouldn't do it again.
Yeah, I would do. I would.
Be he caught that me, that monitor you threw at him and threw it back at you.
Yeah. Cut that shit out.
Because I guess at the beginning, like, I have a lot of goodwill. I'm like, I want to play along. I want to do what the game wants me to do. But once I realize that the relationship is kind of a one-way thing, that I am giving, but I'm not, you know, it's not reciprocal, then I just start, you know, throwing out boxes.
Yeah.
For me, to Bree's question, I would say yes, that the game just isn't introducing enough stuff or reacting enough to me. That's why I would...
It's interesting. I'm thinking, like... The world not reacting enough is a function of the player having so many possible inputs, right? Because, like, think of, like, old adventure games from the 80s where you had, like, 16 verbs at the bottom of the screen. And you could say, like, talk, pick up, whatever. In the world, if you wrote a systemic game, you could write systems that take all 16 of those inputs and... you know, react to them.
Yeah.
But when the inputs are more like move my head 15 degrees to the left and walk forward and shoot my gun, like it's hard to tell what the player's doing.
Yeah. It's hard for the AI to gauge what intent is.
Yes, exactly.
And I have no idea how to deal with that from a writing perspective aside just giving you more options.
Writing for every possible outcome.
Yeah.
But that's where systemic design comes in, because instead of having to write every possible outcome, that if there are inputs into a system and the system does some processing and comes up with outcomes, like, it can be more modular. The outcomes can be made of a set of outcomes.
That terrifies me as a writer, but that's probably the thing I'd want most as someone who plays games.
Like, I feel that if the system was made in such a way that you as a writer were able to put in as many hooks or as few hooks as you wanted to, mm-hmm. I feel that you would feel empowered to, like, do whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
And not have to refer to a programmer or designer. It's like, you don't need permission if you're the one that's doing all the implementation work.
Yeah.
So I think that if it was made in such a fashion, I think you would be in a really, you know, you know, be in a position where you can, like, make the game whatever you want to be.
When you're writing, like, what drives you forward in your writing? Like, are you thinking about a certain plot you want to write? Are you, like, streaming certain game events that need to happen in the game and finding a way to, like, make them go together? Are you thinking about the characters and how you want them to develop? Like, what pushes you forward when you're writing?
Like, on Master Chalice, a lot of it was trying to patch up holes, or just you're trying to connect the world together in a way that
try to connect gameplay mechanics through story that were not originally intended to go together.
Which is what a lot of game writing is. But it's also, like, with how there are so few ways to get writing into the game besides, like, dialogue and the random events. So we had to try to figure out how can we build a world? How can we show this world in those two ways? So, like, random events, we always try to get into do some world building and getting it in there as fast as possible so we can see it. Oh, like, you're trying to save these people who we never actually see in the game, but hopefully we could try to, like, you save this person's farm, like, his kid was going to run into this acid, so how is he going to deal with that loss? And try to build.
So imagine like that situation you just described, like, you need to save people, but you need to be justified in why you want to save them.
Yeah.
So you've just described kind of an abstract situation that could occur in various permutations. So then maybe you need to write, like, 5 different versions of that, considering, like, you're trying to save this kind of character, or you're trying to save this kind of character, or whatever. Like, and you make different versions of that, and then they go into this system, and when they're needed, they're used. So instead of it being just like one-offs, like, oh, we have this situation, it's like, we have this situation, we abstract it a bit so that it could become like 5 or 10 different things.
Mm-hmm. That's like the ideal.
This is how you systematize things.
I like how we kind of circled back on this again by the end.
This is a question for Brendan. 30 Flights and Gravity Bone are both fairly linear, which we have talked about earlier, but I'm curious, how do you funnel players somewhere without making them feel like they're being funneled? Or do you want them to feel like that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess it depends on what you're making. I think for me, the approach that I try to do is just being very cognizant about the places that you're making and making sure that they make sense. Like, if you have a trash can, you have to think, why is that trash can there? And why did they place it there? Why does it make sense to put it there as opposed to over there? Where are they going to dump it out when they need to dump it out? And, like, is it near an elevator? And I think that if you try to be vigilant about that, you'll kind of end up making a place that when they're walking through it, even though you are funneling them, the fact that it feels lived in and it feels like, oh, I can see how someone would use that coffee thing because it's right there. It feels like it's in the right spot. I think for me, it kind of masks the funneling for me.
Can you imagine if you wanted to procedurally generate a world like that?
It sounds really fun.
So, like, you would need to make rules, like, the garbage can needs to be near the elevator because that's where people would put it.
Yeah. But then, like, there's all this, like, a billion other factors that are, like, all bouncing on top of it, mm-hmm. which sounds like a really interesting, fun challenge.
Yes.
Has there been, like, a lot of cross-pollination with people, like, architects coming into game design to help divert eyes and theater prosceniums, like, where they're trying to figure out how they organize the sets on stages to lead the eye along certain ways? There has to be like some sort of rule set that you could proceduralize to help.
Well, there's a book called A Pattern Language by Christopher Alexander, an architect, which changed the field of software design. And he identified like various rules for how cities and houses and rooms should be designed. And he names each rule and he calls it a pattern. And then in software, there's a group of software developers who took that idea and designed design patterns, and they're the same kind of thing. It's like ways you should architect software. And I think you could use the ideas behind that book to generate worlds in games.
I'm thinking of the possibilities. Sorry, I'm just...
Yeah. No, it's okay. I think that games have a lot to teach architecture as well, because when I see parametric stuff being done in architecture, it often is based on like making a cool shape.
Yeah.
Instead of like, what if we designed a language, like an algorithm that would generate a house plan based on the needs of the family? So like this family has 4 kids, they're these ages, the parents work these hours, whatever, some parameters that then, and the lot is south-facing and whatever, like parameters that make sense for the life and how that building will be used, and then come up with a floor plan that is perfect for those people on that lot. Rather than like, oh, if we change this slider, we can get this cool curve here.
Yeah, definitely. One kind of goofy exercise I do is whenever I get lost in a place, I try to think about, as a level designer, how would I fix this? Because like, in my eyes, I'm never wrong. I'm the player. You should be guiding me. And so like, oh, the signage there was you know, backwards on here, so I couldn't see it, and so and so and so.
Is there a common problem that you've found?
I mean, it depends on what your place is trying to do. Like, I find IKEA to be amazing level design.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, my God. Because like, they have secret passages to like give you shortcuts, but you never see them, or at least I never noticed them. And it's amazing. Then you go backwards and you realize, oh, the secret passage was that way. I had to go backwards to see it. But then you look at like casinos, which is,
yeah,
you know, level design obfuscation, which is like, we want you to not exit. And so there's lots of things to learn about how to not guide you to a place,
yeah,
which is also interesting.
And how people use the place, like you're saying, the player is never wrong. One of the things Christopher Alexander writes about is like, if you see often where there's like a sidewalk connect to another sidewalk, the grass on a curve is all destroyed because no one takes the sidewalk to the sidewalk. They cut across the grass at the point where it's natural to turn. And so that's where there should be a sidewalk. That's where everyone's walking.
That's interesting.
So we need to get like a software kit that shows you where your grass is being trodden in your game so you can build more
stuff. I think we already track all of that.
Yeah, I think we are there. At least shooters are.
We look at which parts of the world are being used or not.
Yeah.
Before the game is released in playtests, we see, like, are they going to these areas or not? And we try to balance the game to draw people into parts of the map they're not using and stuff like this.
Okay, and last question for both of you. Like, Child of Light and your games, Brendan, both deal with pacing a lot and place a lot of importance on pacing. How do you handle it?
I mean, it depends on what kind of game you're making. I think for, like, a linear first-person thing, I think the way that I've been trying to do it is just depends on what are you... So if the player's playing a role, then it becomes, like, what is the player doing at this given moment? Like, in 30 Flights of Loving, when you're escaping from the airport, that is done through a bunch of really kind of really quick smash cuts. And so during those things, during those little scenes, the player is kind of encouraged to move forward as quickly as possible because you're trying to escape from this place. And so when you're doing that and the music is going and there's tons of people around you and you're a little bit confused, and so that kind of, you know, creates this peak of what's happening. Lots of things are moving around, lots of stimulus. And then it cuts to the hideout where Anita is eating an orange and, you know, the music stops. And that's a very, you know, sledgehammer way of stopping all the pacing of, things have stopped now. You can walk around and things, there's no more stimulus now except for a person eating an orange. And so that's kind of the way that 30 Flights try to do it.
Are you thinking about pacing a lot as you're making games?
Yeah, because I think that sometimes one thing that I try to be careful about is to be cognizant of those peaks and valleys. Because, like, if a game is at 11 all the time, I get, like, physically exhausted. I can't play anymore. And the same thing for having, like, a game that's at, you know, at a 1 the entire time. It depends on what you're making, but for me, like, the things that I like to make, I like to have lots of variations.
Yeah, I think it's necessary. You're just making me think about in The Simpsons Tapped Out, which I'm playing so much right now, they release, like, sort of one-off special challenges every once in a while. So, like, for 1 month, last month, they had this thing where they made a new gameplay and you're building a monorail and there's all these new things you have to do, and it was on a different pacing than the rest of the game. Like, normally the game is like you kind of pick it up every few hours and you do a few things and you put it down there and you can't really do much else until a few hours are up. But during this month, like, you can play it more frequently, and then, like, it's really exciting and you have, like, a certain number of days to get a certain number of things done, and it's stressful and you don't know if you're going to make it and you're trying to beat your friends. And then that whole challenge just goes away and you're back to the regular game. And then for a month, like, you'll be back to the regular game, and then, like, eventually they'll release another one that's different. And it, you know, it wouldn't be interesting if they didn't do that. But so for things like that, the reason I bring that up is I think it's interesting because it's a systemic game that they're trying to put some pacing on. And, like, for linear games, we can draw on what we know about pacing from other media, but then, like, for systemic games, what's pacing? Do we need it? Do we not need it? I don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, because, like, I think, what was it, Left 4 Dead, this kind of this weird blend, right, of...
The director.
This director... It's this weird mixture of linear gameplay ideas plus systemic things, in that you're kind of, like, tracking the player's health and when's the last time they got attacked and then trying to figure out when's the right time to do another attack to make it, to give this experience, this very specific experience to the player.
I think we're going to call it.
Or wait. So, Brendan and Bree, are you playing any other games besides The Simpsons? And Brendan, are you playing anything else besides Prison Architect?
I'm not allowed to play any other games until I've gotten something done.
Okay.
Ooh, that I can't say what it is. But, yes.
Interesting. Brendan?
I'm playing Metal Gear Solid 5 right now.
Quick thoughts on Metal Gear Solid 5, The Phantom Pain.
I'm a person that kind of bounced off of the previous Metal Gear games. For some reason, they didn't work for me. But this one is kind of an open world game where it's just a bunch of... You're just let loose in the sandbox and you can do whatever you want. And that genre appeals to me a lot. So I'm having a blast with it.
As someone who bounced off of the narrative of Metal Gear games, what do you think of this narrative?
You know what? They do a good job of making it optional for people like me. Because like it assumes you know a lot about the Metal Gear games, it seems, and I know nothing, and I'm fine with just having it go over my head.
Good. On that note, we're going to call it. Brendan, where can people find you on the internet?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at BlendoGames, and my site is BlendoGames.com.
Bree, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter at BrieCode, BrieCode, or BrieCode.tumblr.com.
I am Max Folk Max on Twitter, and
I am Twin Made Films on Twitter,
and the podcast is Scriptlock Cast on Twitter. So follow that if you want to get updates about this weird podcast we're making. And yeah.
Awesome.
That's it. Thank you guys for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, this is great. Thanks.
All right, I'm shutting this down.